Welcome to episode 26 of Understanding Latin American Politics, the podcast. I'm Greg Weeks. I'm a political scientist at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. And today I'm talking with Elizabeth Stein, who is the Mark Helmke Postdoctoral Scholar of Global Media Development and Democracy, and also a visiting assistant professor at Indiana University School of Global and International Studies. She does work on authoritarian and semi-authoritarian governments and recently published a piece in The Monkey Cage comparing Donald Trump and Latin American presidents with regard to attacking the media. So Liz, thank you so much for taking some time.
Well, thank you for inviting me on your show.
All right. Well, I want to start with a question that I've been asking everyone. And that is, what got you interested in studying Latin American politics?
Well, the quick answer is that I grew up studying Spanish starting at 13, and my parents advocated us studying abroad. My older sister went to Madrid, and I wanted to rebel, and so I went to Latin America and ended up spending a semester in Buenos Aires.
What kind of experience was that, going to Buenos Aires?
It was excellent. It was not at all what I had expected of Latin America, having grown up probably with a bunch of people from Mexico and Central America at my school. When I got there, it was when the dollar was pegged to the peso, so everything was super expensive.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, it was interesting, and mostly what I benefited from was when we traveled to, like, the northwest of Argentina and up into Bolivia, and then afterward I spent 6 weeks traveling around Brazil.
Oh, okay, awesome. And so you speak, I think you did field work in Brazil too, so you speak both Spanish and Portuguese.
Correct. I took Portuguese right before I went to Argentina, I had been pre-med and then dropped all my classes and took 2 Latin American politics classes in 3 languages before I went.
Excellent.
And that was the semester that I had the best professor I had, which is the reason I'm a professor, which was Dr. Schultz, who I believe you have experience with as well.
Yes, he was my PhD advisor. Definitely it's been an inspiration for lots of people. So, and I'm sure he was glad, too, that you decided to drop pre-med and end up doing what you're doing.
Yeah. Well, I will give my parents credit. They didn't say a thing, but he is the reason I'm the other kind of doctor.
Exactly. Now, getting to the work that you've done, and then specifically the article that was in The Monkey Cage, which I really enjoyed. Here's a question to start with, is that presidents making claims about fake news is not a new phenomenon in Latin America. It is in the U.S., but not there. So tell me a little bit about why presidents make such claims and what the effect has been.
Sure. It is part of a larger rhetoric that they use to discredit the media, and it's not all presidents that do this.
True.
But in particular, presidents that are on the left, mostly with a populist tendency, they do it to make the media appear dishonest or even vindictive, and it helps them set the media up as an opponent to the regime. And in the case of populist presidents, if you're an opponent to the regime, you're an opponent to the people, or at least the supporters of the government. And so this particularly happens when there's like a collapse in the party system, so there's not a partisan opposition there. And since they're still, you know, at that point, they're all still democratic. And so they need an opposition. And so they turn the media into their opposition.
Yeah. And it's interesting, too, because in the U.S., you know, we didn't have we have populism, but not in the same way that it emerged in Latin America, because our party system didn't collapse. We used to have a populist kind of ramming himself into one of the existing parties. And it just makes me think, too, of why someone like Trump would actually need to create an opposition when he has an opposition.
Yeah, that is something that my co-author and I have wondered a little bit about. I think in part, perhaps because there was, you know, already some like a fissure in the Democratic Party after the Democrats have tried to make it as though there's not. Bernie's supported Clinton throughout, but I think perhaps because of that, but I don't actually have a great answer for that.
Yeah, no, it's sort of more speculation. But certainly in Latin America, the evolution of populism and the populist president's response to the opposition has really taken a different tack because of the fact that the U.S. wasn't having that sort of crisis necessarily. The parties were unpopular, but not a complete crisis where parties were disintegrating and disappearing.
Right. In fact, the Republican Party probably has more of that problem with the rise of the Tea Party and sort of a fissure and major shift in the direction of the Republicans.
Yeah. No, that's true. Oddly enough, the Latin American examples that we see are really from the left, and Trump is on the right. Do you see any particular reason why the U.S. and Latin America would be mirror images of each other?
I think it has a lot to do with the media system itself. Populists in general can be on the left or the right. But in Latin America, the media has historically been concentrated. It's privately owned, but concentrated in the hands of a few large, very wealthy conservative families. And so it's easy for the left to frame them as the opposition. It's a contentious relationship by nature, and it's believable. It's a little less straightforward in the United States because the media isn't as unified ideologically. We have some diversity, particularly even in the mainstream with Fox News. But if you can somehow discount Fox News as being part of the mainstream, which I think Fox News does a pretty good job of telling its viewers that it's separate, there is a perception that our media is liberally biased in the U.S. sense, not in the Latin American sense.
Right.
And so in that sense, you know, he can frame the New York Times, the Washington Post, and, you know, sort of exclude Fox Media from the mainstream and say the mainstream media is biased against him and they're liberal. And
right. And actually, that's another thing, too. It makes comparisons difficult because in Latin America, when you think of corporate media, you really are thinking of very traditional right-wing media. And so that if a government, I was thinking of Chile in the 1960s, early 1970s, that you had El Mercurio that was adamantly opposed to the government and made that clear, and it was owned by an elitist family, whereas corporate media in the U.S. is being blamed for being leftist somehow.
Which, yeah, in and of itself, it's strange. I think there's, you know, perhaps greater independence of media, both from the ownership of, you know, a lot of the U.S. companies, too, are publicly owned as opposed to owned by private families. I think the New York Times being one of the exceptions. But also the journalists from, say, the top of the paper have a bit more independence. And journalists, even in Latin America, on average, are probably liberal.
Right. So you're saying they have less discretion.
I think in Latin America they're more constrained by ownership and by their editors than in the U.S.
That's true.
Not to say that there aren't constraints in the U.S., but I think that there's a longer tradition of professional journalism with some sense of objectivity or neutrality up until now.
Right.
I think there's still a sense of objectivity. Neutrality is something different.
Yes, that's true. Now, in thinking about kind of coming back to populism, one of the things about populism is trying to connect directly to your followers. And to what degree do you think is Trump's direct communication, like especially Twitter, with his supporters similar to Latin American examples?
Several of the Latin American presidents had taken to having talk shows where they would hear the people's problems, they would give them things, help solve their problems. So as opposed to, say, taking a policy approach that might improve their lives, they could just appease people. It's very charismatic and, you know, makes for good publicity. More recently, I think some have taken to social media, in particular Correa in Ecuador. He's been not only to his supporters where, you know, he listens to their problems and answers them, but he's also been trolling his opposition members, you know, taking on comedians in the United States that have criticized him. So I think, you know, it's certainly similar tactics.
I think it would be funny to think of Trump doing his own TV show. For some reason, I feel like he's actually less interested in mixing personally with his followers than perhaps Correa or Hugo Chavez was.
Yeah, and that might be the difference between the left and the right. Although he did have his own TV show, just not as
well. Okay, no, that's true. That's true. Slightly different kind of TV show, I suppose.
Yeah, I actually have never watched it, so I don't even know what it's like.
I don't either. What I know about it mostly I get from his tweets, and I generally he has something against Arnold Schwarzenegger, and I don't actually fully get it all. But
the world is upside down when I start supporting Schwarzenegger's politics.
Yes, that's right. And you know, thinking even of Twitter is that for the United States, this kind of personalized, whimsical use of Twitter is new and kind of disconcerting. But this has been going on in Latin America for quite a long time.
Definitely. I mean, I find it disconcerting everywhere. But
that's true.
I think when it's not happening in your country, perhaps it's a bit more entertaining.
Yes, that is true. It's funny when Rafael Correa is going after American comedians outside the country, but that's just because he's not your president.
Right, and he's also not going to have any influence over somebody outside in that sense.
Yes, true. You have an article in Comparative Political Studies that argues the media is vulnerable to presidential attacks on its freedom when his or her ideological position is contrary to the media, and when legislatures and judiciaries are weak relative to the president. Is this a key, like especially the institutional strength, is this key to avoiding some of the Latin American outcomes?
I sure hope it is. But I wouldn't actually put a whole lot of faith in our current Congress. Perhaps after midterms we can rethink that. But I do think the judiciary is going to help, along with civil society organizations and even civil society organizations related to judicial causes like the ACLU or the Southern Poverty Law Center. So far, they've given us good signs that, you know, they won't sit by while there's executive orders being passed that they view as unconstitutional. But I also think that constant pressure from united opposition protests is essential to, you know, keeping the judiciary on its toes and also probably pressuring Congress to some degree to push back on some of the more extreme rhetoric and measures that President Trump has taken. And we've seen a little bit of that in Congress, but I suspect over time maybe a larger group might do so.
But in general, is that the answer? I mean, to avoid, especially if we think about the specifics of attacks on the media, is it really is the legislature, is Congress and the courts, are they really our best hope? I mean, I know there could be protests, but, you know, is that really what's going to be the barrier to further attacks and erosion of free speech?
I think in large part that is, and it's not that they themselves, it's not that the institutions necessarily do it. It's the whoever occupies the institutions actually chooses to use the powers that they have.
True.
So that's why we've seen in Latin American cases, even where the laws, you know, grant the Congress measures, when they're all of the same party as the government or the opposition's super fragmented and weak, they either can't or choose not to use their powers to challenge the president. The other thing in the U.S. is that we do have probably more protections apart from just a broad declaration of press freedom, but like our actual laws on defamation, for instance, are, you know, better for journalists than they would be in Latin America. We don't have criminal penalties for it. There's a much higher barrier for public figures, whereas in Latin America, public figures actually get special protection. So it's, you know, I think we have further to fall, so it hopefully would take a lot more to deteriorate press freedom. And we still have independent judiciary that's less politicized, I think.
And do you think, it was just occurring to me too, is that in Latin America, you generally see very strong executives, whereas in the U.S. there's a variety. We tend to think the president's a lot stronger than
True, true. Yeah, no, that's definitely true that the president in Latin America has much stronger unilateral powers in most countries than in the, for sure than the U.S., but, you know, most countries in Latin America do have very strong presidents. And, you know, that's helped. It's also part of the culture that the president, you know, pushes through stuff. It's their agenda, their budget. So, you know, there's a lot of things that could work in the U.S. favor. But, you know, we've already seen him take some measures. He's already kept certain outlets out of press briefings. And, you know, I'm a little bit of a pessimist, so it scares me.
Yes, well, that's what I was going to say, is that I'm casting around here for optimism of some sort of a glass half full view.
Oh, that was me being optimistic before.
That was you being optimistic before. Okay. Well, then I'm just at least trying to say, well, that structurally in Latin America, things are much worse, so there's much less of a chance.
Correct. There is less of a chance. But we're seeing all kinds of things we've never seen before in the U.S., or at least not in my lifetime. So I don't think we're going to end up like Venezuela.
Okay. I was going to thank you, because I was going to say, if that was your optimism, then I would hate to see your pessimism.
You probably would. But, yeah, you know, not Venezuela, perhaps, but, you know, some of perhaps Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner's attacks and things like
that. So if we keep our bar low, we're not going to be Venezuela, then we can everything is golden from there.
Exactly. No, you know, I try and remain positive because I'm teaching media and politics from a comparative perspective right now, and I don't want to freak my students out too much.
Right.
But it was interesting because this past week I was grading. They do a media journal where they have to pay attention to like 10 different sources and you know, different mediums, different ideology, and so just to see what their perceptions are going in, it's very interesting.
Yeah, I could imagine it is. And I can't really imagine being 18, 19, 20 and trying to navigate all this.
Yeah, no, I think that, excuse me, perhaps not having that much, you know, interaction with mainstream media, because really they all get stuff online.
Right.
It doesn't freak them out very much. They don't seem particularly alarmed. A few of them, you know, mention in their journals that when they start really reading the content and how much stuff there is about Trump and criticism, that it worries them a little bit.
Right. Now, at what point do you think that President Trump, or really any president, I even think of the Latin American cases, at what point does complaining about the media cross the line into infringement on media freedom? So in other words, when does whining kind of shift toward authoritarianism?
Sure. I mean, I think his rhetoric in and of itself is dangerous. All presidents complain about the media. I mean, that's if the media is doing their job, you know, they shouldn't like the media. They shouldn't be buddies with the media. But, you know, calling some of our most established media outlets fake news and casting doubt among the population, I mean, it erodes confidence in a free press. And, you know, where do you get your news if you can't trust our mainstream media? But he, you know, I think the scarier issues are tactics like, you know, not answering questions of particular outlets. Mm-hmm. You know, if CNN, even if they can attend every press briefing, but they never get called on, you know, who's going to actually be asking the hard pressing questions and be persistent when the president or Sean Spicer doesn't answer them?
Right.
And then I think, you know, like, that, I guess it was last week already, right, when they kept out the New York Times, Politico, Washington Post, a handful of others. And, you know, I think those out, the ones that they actually keep out aren't the problem so much because they're very strong and they'll keep going. They have financial backing. But the message it then sends to people that perhaps, or media outlets that are sort of on the border right now or smaller and can't defend themselves in court financially, is probably already led to a bit of self-censorship that we'll never know about because you don't know what people aren't writing.
Yeah, and self-censorship, I think, is a good point because what you see in Latin America in some cases are refusal to renew licenses and that sort of thing. But at the same time, just having rhetorical attacks means that a lot of people are going to shift their reporting to some degree just to try to avoid having such problems in the first place.
Correct. I mean, you know, like I have this because I was just living in Brazil for the past 3 years and with my Brazilian colleagues, and I get that biased media in Latin America is a huge problem. But, you know, my contention is I'd rather have biased media that I know is biased, where I can discount and adjust for that, as opposed to censored media where you really don't know what you're not learning about unless you personally are interacting with it. And so to me, that's far scarier, is this sort of doubt that he's, you know, putting in people's minds when they come to, like, should I write that story or not, or should I quote this person or not, that maybe on the edges we're starting not to get some of the more controversial stuff.
Right. And would you agree, too, that the sort of culture about media is different in Latin America than the U.S.? Because in the U.S. we have an obsession with claiming that we're objective, whereas in Latin America, media outlets tend to have pretty open biases. It's just that you have access to all different kinds of biases.
You mean in the U.S. or in...
No, that in Latin America, you can buy, this paper will be on the right, this paper will be on the left, and you kind of know that, and nobody tries to pretend otherwise, whereas in the U.S., we try to pretend that we're objective.
Yeah, I mean, I think it does depend on the country. You know, Argentina has, say, a paper that everybody knows is on the left, but... Brazil, it's a, you know, outside of like one news magazine, there's not, and then very independent outlets that don't reach the masses. There's not a whole lot of anything on the left.
Okay, yeah, I guess I had experience with Chile where it was very obvious at any time. If you want to get something from one particular view, you just kind of know which paper to buy, but they were all available widely.
Yes, that is true, and it's still mostly limited to print. Once you get into broadcast, you know, outside of community radio, it's until cases like Ecuador and Venezuela, where they've started taking over media and they use the financial crisis to their advantage by taking up the debt. And now there's privately owned media. I mean, sorry, publicly owned or state media.
Right.
But, you know, at the top levels of media in Latin America, it's all conservative.
Yes, that's true. And then finally, actually, yes, the question of state-owned media is also distinct. That is common in Latin America and certainly not in the U.S. to just have something that's owned by the state.
Yeah, and that's actually, I mean, either a very, very old phenomenon or a relatively new phenomenon. But at the end of the day, if they don't produce interesting content, you know, people don't watch. I think that the numbers were like in Ecuador or Venezuela, one of the, there's like, you know, state media is now like 30% of media, but they only get 5% of viewership because... Oh. The content just isn't all that interesting.
No, watching Nicolas Maduro do salsa dancing or something gets old after a while.
Yeah, or Chavez talk for 8 hours straight. Or
yeah, that too. That certainly will get old.
Hopefully we won't have to deal with that.
No.
Trump doesn't seem like he might be able to like hold his own attention for 8 hours straight.
No, that's a good point. Good point. Okay, so we are out of time. I've been talking to Liz Stein, who is the Mark Helmke Postdoctoral Scholar of Global Media Development and Democracy and a visiting assistant professor at Indiana University School of Global and International Studies. Liz, thanks so much again for doing this.
Oh, thank you for having me on your podcast.